Coming up, Fred Sam Lazaro on the scourge of sex trafficking in Vietnam.
We were told that if we didn't agree to be wives, we would be sold into brothels.
Also, Saul Gonzalez on trying to save historic church buildings when their congregations have become too small to keep them up.
This is a national crisis, I would say. It really is a national crisis.
Major funding for Religion at Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And by these funders.
Welcome. I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Relief groups this week rushed to deliver aid to Iraqis fleeing the sectarian violence that has gripped their country. An estimated 1.5 million people, including some Christians, have been displaced so far by the Islamist Sunni insurgency. The UN agency, UNICEF, gave the situation in Iraq its most severe disaster grade, level 3, the same as the crisis in Syria. This week, President Obama said American combat troops are not going to be fighting in Iraq again, but that the U.S. is sending up to 300 military advisors.
There's no military solution inside of Iraq, certainly not one that is led by the United States. But there is an urgent need for an inclusive political process, a more capable Iraqi security force, and counterterrorism efforts that deny groups like ISIL a safe haven.
There's been a deadly string of attacks in Kenya. More than 60 people in several coastal villages were killed by gunmen who went door to door asking if those inside were Muslim. Those who answered no were shot. The Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility, but the Kenyan government said its political rivals are to blame. This week, the government said it killed 5 people suspected of having been involved in the attacks. Here at home, the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church USA gathered in Detroit to vote on a series of hotly debated issues. Delegates approved a resolution allowing pastors to perform same-sex marriages in states where it's legal. That change goes into effect immediately. Delegates also voted to change the church's definition of marriage from a covenant between a man and a woman to a covenant between two people. That change requires regional approval. Americans are giving less to churches and more to other kinds of causes, according to a new report from Giving USA and the Indiana University Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. Donations to religious groups fell 1.6% from 2012 to 2013, despite the fact that charitable giving overall was up 3%. Among the groups receiving increased giving, education, the arts and humanities, and environmental and animal protection organizations. There were 3 executions in the U.S. in the span of 24 hours this week. They were the first executions since April, when an Oklahoma inmate died of a heart attack after a botched lethal injection. This week's injections were carried out amid a growing debate about whether states should have to disclose where the drugs come from. The executions took place in Florida, Georgia, and Missouri, each of which has refused to say where it got the drugs. The Vatican announced that Pope Francis is canceling all of his Wednesday general audiences for the month of July. The cancellations led some to speculate that the Pope's health is suffering because of his grueling schedule. However, the Vatican rushed to downplay the rumors, saying the Pope is not sick. Meanwhile, on Friday, the Pope came out against legalizing recreational drugs. Francis was visited this week by Archbishop of Canterbury Justin Welby, the head of the Anglican Communion. It was their second meeting. They discussed their opposition to human trafficking and committed themselves to the fight against slavery in all forms. We have a special report now on the continuing tragedy of sex trafficking in Vietnam. Poor country girls tricked into going across the border into China, where they're offered a choice between marriage and a brothel. But some of the girls escape, and once they return, there are people trying to help them get back into school and learn job skills. Fred DeSam Lazaro reports from the Vietnam-China border.
The Communist Party flag still flies high in Vietnam, but on the ground, consumerism and capitalism are thriving, at least in cities like Ho Chi Minh, the former Saigon, and the capital, Hanoi, which have grown rapidly.
You see enormous amounts of mobility within the country, rural-urban migration happening at a large scale.
However, Forster says the strong economic growth of recent years has not been enough to absorb millions of young entrants to the job market in this nation of 90 million.
We have currently about 400,000 Vietnamese migrant workers being deployed abroad at any time, with 80,000 leaving every year. And whenever you have migration, which is a positive driver and a positive force, then you have also the exploitation and abuse coming with it. And that leads to trafficking.
The heart of both the sex and labor trafficking problem and much of Vietnam's poverty lies in the rural hinterland, still home to two-thirds of the population.
This is Vietnam's back door, the rugged, mountainous, remote region along the northern border with China. It's a porous border through which thousands of Vietnamese women, children, and some men are trafficked each year. Exact numbers are hard to pin down, and that's just one of the challenges in getting a handle on this complex problem.
China is a giant magnet. Its wages are higher, and it's a transit point to other countries. China's also an involuntary destination for many young Vietnamese women. China's one-child policy, combined with the cultural preference for male children, has created a shortage of brides. California-based Yip Wong, originally from Vietnam, founded the Pacific Lynx Foundation, which helps victims who've managed to escape.
The girls that we see, they are given a choice. Do you want to marry somebody? Or do you want to work in the brothels? And one of the girls told us that she said, you know, they told us that if we work in brothels, we'll be staying near the border. And so some girls say, you know, I'd rather stay here because it's closer to Vietnam and I may be able to run back.
Vuong brought me to visit 23-year-old Lan, who was able to run back.
I don't know where I was taken. We were in the car for a day. And when they wouldn't let me out of the car, then I realized I'd been tricked.
Hers is a classic story of how traffickers prey on desperately poor people.
Lan was working on a road-building crew. It's back-breaking work in hot, stifling weather. And it's to her work site that the recruiter came with a better offer, to harvest cinnamon for higher wages. She and two others took the bait, but Lan was the only one who managed to return to her village. The other two have not been heard from since.
Lan said she was held in a home across the border in China before being taken to a place she thought was Beijing, where she encountered the police.
When we got to Beijing, there were a lot of policemen around, so I ran to them and asked them to help me. They showed me a computer screen, and I was able to convey to them that I was from Vietnam.
But after clarifying a few questions, Vuong determined Lan wasn't describing Beijing, but rather an airport. She'd never seen one before.
You know, I mean, you see airport pictures all the time, the Malaysian Airlines story and all that. And then you come across people who actually at the airport and don't even know that they've been at the airport.
Lan was fortunate in one critical way. Her family welcomed her back. She's since married and has a one-year-old son. Often, victims must deal with stigma, shame, and rejection from their families.
My mother doesn't care to see me anymore. In my village, there were some young women who had returned from China, and I remember looking down on them, and that's how I thought people were looking at me.
Hui and Fuang, we were asked to conceal the identities of trafficking victims, were vulnerable to peer pressure and seemingly compelling requests for help.
There was this boy, he lived below us, and he told me that his brother had a bad accident in China. And he asked me if I wanted to go with him to take care of his brother.
My cousin told me he was dumped by his girlfriend and really depressed and asked if I would go and hang out with him.
But their friends lied to them. Each teenager was handed over to members of shadowy trafficking networks.
We were told that if we didn't agree to be wives, we would be sold into brothels.
Fuang agreed. Hui did not, and was sold to a brothel, where she says she was held for several days, but not yet put to work.
They were waiting to find a client for me. Luckily, there was a police raid, and because we didn't have papers, the police took us away.
Each tells harrowing escape stories, how chance encounters with police officials and kind strangers helped get them home. In many cases, Wong says victims become traffickers.
The Ministry of Public Security had said that they, of all the people they arrested as trafficker, 60% of them had been trafficking victims themselves.
Wong described one encounter she had with a 17-year-old who was severely beaten in captivity and released on condition that she recruit more young women, which she agreed to do.
And she said, well, I told them that, you know, they will work at this restaurant. And so she didn't say that, you know, they will have to serve as prostitute.
So why would she feel compelled to feed this trade then, if she was free?
Do you ask an abused woman who's abused by her husband why she goes back to her husband, or why does she let her husband beat up on their children knowing that, you know, what the harm she suffered is terrible enough?
For young women unable to return to their families, Wong's group provides safe haven. They learn basic life skills like cooking and can complete their schooling. About 4,000 young women have received scholarships with money Wong raises through private donations. That enables them to go to school and, where possible, train for job skills. One partner is another nonprofit called No One Teach One, or KOTO. Its restaurants and culinary schools in Ho Chi Minh City and Hanoi train disadvantaged youth. For her part, 50-year-old Yip Wong, who fled Vietnam after the war, plans to keep pushing to strengthen this country's anti-trafficking laws.
I became a boat person when I was 16, and I spent 3 days on the sea. And I arrived in Singapore realizing for the first time that I'm stateless, and all the vulnerabilities that I saw during those times, certainly I don't want to see it on anyone. Being a Buddhist, in some ways, not very devout, I feel that, you know, there are times to do things. And clearly there was a time for me to study. There was a time for me to take the crossing of the sea to understand how vulnerable people are, people could be. And so there's a time to do something, then just do it.
In 2013, Vietnam arrested nearly 700 alleged traffickers and identified some 900 rescued victims. Most experts agree there are deficiencies in both anti-trafficking laws and their enforcement, and that those numbers represent a small fraction, Fuang says a tenth, perhaps, of the true figures. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred de Sam Lazaro in Hanoi.
This month in Philadelphia, the Roman Catholic Archdiocese announced that it's closing 16 more parish churches and merging them with others, part of a 4-year downsizing campaign. Meanwhile, all over the country, struggles are underway to save historic church buildings as congregations and their contributions dwindle. There's a national nonprofit organization, also based in Philadelphia, called Partners for Sacred Places, that's helping find new uses for old and beloved church buildings. Saul Gonzalez reports.
Philadelphia is a city rich in landmarks, from Independence Hall to the Ben Franklin Parkway to its works of playful public art. The City of Brotherly Love is also home to an extraordinary variety of imposing and historic houses of worship scattered across its neighborhoods. But many of these grand buildings sit long closed and derelict, with broken windows, locked doors, and for sale signs on them. Other churches, both closed and open, are in simply terrible condition. Take the 19th Street Baptist Church in South Philadelphia. Built in 1874, it was partly designed by Frank Furness, one of the city's most celebrated architects. Wilbur Winborn is 19th Street's pastor.
It's almost like a version of this old house, where you look at a house, it's in a state of deterioration, and we need a lot of people and a lot of resources to come and to try to help and get this house of worship back on its feet again.
This old house times 100.
Times 100. This old house times 100.
Look inside the church and you can see why the congregation can't hold services in the main worship space and why the church needs upwards of $3 million in renovation work done.
How did your church get in the shape that it's in?
Well, years of neglect. It's not having the resources that we needed to have. So between neglect, lack of resources and help, and this is what we have.
And although this church's condition is extreme, religious leaders and architectural preservationists say too many other historic churches in Philadelphia and other American cities are in similar shape.
I think it's fair to say this is a national crisis, I would say. It really is a national crisis.
Bob Yeager is president of the organization Partners for Sacred Places. It's a Philadelphia-based national nonprofit dedicated to protecting America's historic and endangered houses of worship.
What's your uniqueness there, really? Okay.
Congregations have shrunk so much, and budgets have shrunk so much, that it's hard for congregations to keep up with their buildings, to take good care of them, or to use them well. And unless they do something creative and bold, many of them will close or merge in the next 10, 20 years.
In Philadelphia alone, with an estimated 800 houses of worship, Yeager estimates between 1 to 200 churches are at risk of closing. That's already happened to North Philadelphia's Ascension of Our Lord Roman Catholic Church. It shut its doors permanently in 2012 after years of financial troubles. But even as its fortunes declined, the church remained a crossroads of community life in this largely poor African-American and Latino neighborhood, says resident Jeff Johnson.
And this church, man, I used to go to this church when I was young. A waste of space. Like, they should open it back up and do something with it, right?
Bob Yeager says even people who never step inside a house of worship should recognize the loss to a neighborhood's sense of community when a church, synagogue, or temple closes.
You may love the architecture. You may love the fact that it houses a concert or a recital every month. You may love the fact that kids in your community go to daycare. You may love the fact that the homeless are sheltered there in the wintertime. So there are ways where you may not be a member, but you can say, you know, this is a place that matters.
To save churches on the brink, staffers at Partners for Sacred Places help negotiate deals on behalf of houses of worship, so that they can earn extra income by inviting other tenants to share their spaces, renting them out to social service organizations and art groups, for instance. That's what Partners for Sacred Places helped to do for Philadelphia's massive Shiloh Baptist Church. Like so many other houses of worship in this city, it's crumbling and dilapidated. Small children's pools have been set out to catch rainwater from leaking ceilings. And the church's congregation is now so small, they rarely use the main worship space because of the cost of heating it. But on the church's second floor, there are sights and sounds of new life. To earn extra income, the church has rented out this massive space to Junk, an avant-garde dance and performing arts group that tours the country.
Junk brings... we bring a lot of energy wherever we go.
Junk's artistic director, Brian Sanders, fell in love with the space the first moment he saw it, knowing it would be perfect for his high-flying performers. But Sanders also had doubts whether a risk-taking secular theater group could share a sacred space with a church congregation.
Junk is known for, you know, pushing boundaries, and so the idea of our, you know, how we were going to be able to find common ground inside of church sounded challenging. But when we really sat down at the table, we shared more in common than we knew.
The church and performers also realized they could help each other. Junk needed offices and a big, affordable rehearsal space right in the city. The church needed the sense of life and extra money Junk's presence and rent would bring in. Reverend Edward Sparkman is Shiloh's pastor.
It is bringing in approximately $30,000 of extra income a year, which we did not have before we started this.
And that $30,000 matters.
Oh, yes, yes. You can't maintain this building without the additional income, and we realize that now.
Bob Yeager thinks that's an example of what other older urban churches with shrinking congregations could and should be doing.
Their buildings can stay alive, and they can be cared for, and they can be shared in new ways, and they can kind of live out their public purpose in new ways. And that's good for everybody.
But in cities with revived residential and commercial real estate markets, there are people who see opportunity, profit, and curb appeal in all of these old and abandoned churches. The key, though, as they say in real estate, is location, 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 and turning these houses of worship into places that have nothing to do with faith.
That's what's happening at what was St. Matthew's Baptist Church in South Philadelphia. Closed in 2011, it's now being turned into over 30 luxury apartment units for young professionals.
So when you saw this building, what is it that attracted you to it immediately?
Well, immediately it's the exterior, the stone, the detail, that iconic clock tower that is so fantastic. You see it from everywhere. And then its sheer size. This is this is not a little chapel. This is a giant building.
The man behind this church makeover is Philadelphia-based real estate developer Alon Barzilay, who's spending $10 million on the project.
This is the very top of the worship space.
Absolutely. This is the second story of the bi-level apartments, and you can see the amazing arch details of the ceiling that goes throughout.
Barzilay's not alone in doing this kind of work. Churches have been turned into swank single-family homes, stores and commercial spaces, even a brewery and pub. In Philadelphia, Barzilay thinks the property possibilities are endless because of the stock of old and abandoned houses of worship in the city.
They have to be of scale. They have to have good location. You have to have a community that's working with you because they're very challenging. But it's a niche that we are specializing in, and this is the first of many churches that we are currently examining to redevelop.
But sitting with me in a grand downtown Philadelphia church, Bob Yeager has ambivalent feelings about some church conversions.
Condominiums tend to cut up the space. You know, you put in lots of walls, and the glory of a space like this would be lost. But that's certainly better than demolition.
Back at 19th Street Baptist Church, a small crew of volunteers does what it can to shore up this building, using what funds the small congregation can raise. Pastor Winborn, who came to this church after much of the damage to the building had already been done, says he would love to share the church with other organizations to bring in needed income. He also says he'll do everything in his power to make sure this historic church remains a church.
If a developer came to you and said, $10 million or $7 million or $6 million for your church, but I want to turn it into something else entirely different, I would assume that'd be tempting.
Not quite. Not quite. It's a history. We want to leave a legacy. You can't put a price on that. You can't put a price on that.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Saul Gonzalez in Philadelphia.
On our calendar for Muslims, the holy month of Ramadan begins next weekend, the annual period of prayer, good deeds, and fasting from dawn to sunset every day. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website, where there's always much more and where you can also listen to or watch each of our programs. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes of Pope Francis greeting some of his many fans.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And by these funders.